Let's get started in Genesis chapter 38 with this interesting story of Judah. Judah's the second son of his father. And so far, what we've learned about Judah in the immediate history has not been good. As Joseph's story unfolds, what role has Judah already played in Joseph's story? Yeah, well, too, he looks like he's probably involved in both efforts. All of them, maybe except for Reuben, think about killing him early on. And then Judah has this economic idea, let's sell him and get something out of it. So I don't know about old Judah so far. He's kind of a redemption story. Judah is not a good guy in the early stages, based on that, based on the bad report that Joseph gave. But he kind of comes around later. Some of what he says later when it has to do with Benjamin and his father, remember that a little later in our story? And then Judah is the background, the history, the lineage of Jesus. And there's some redemption story there as well. Let's talk about this a little bit. Starting early on, question one, who did Judah marry and what is wrong with this picture? Judah marries a Canaanite woman. We do not know her name. We know her mother's name. But he marries this Canaanite woman and they have two children, two boys. Question two, what kind of boys were these and what happened to them? This is not going well. Very wicked. One of them is very wicked and is put to death. And the next one does something sinful as well. And God gets angry with him and he gets put to death. And it's going very, very poorly. So question three, how does this story mirror what we've seen in previous lessons about the Jews intermarrying with the people of the land? This is not a good idea. Now, I have a very difficult follow-up question I'm going to pose to you in a minute. But for now, I would say that consistently through the Old Testament, the idea of God's pure people intermarrying with those of idolatry and sinfulness is a recipe for disaster. We've seen it a lot. I just made a couple of notes. Genesis 24, verses 1 through 4, don't do it. I think that was the case of Isaac and his son, do not get him a bride who is of this land. Deuteronomy 7, don't do it. Moses is preaching to the people before they entered into the land, don't do it. Malachi, I'll go all the way to the end. I'm giving you a front, middle, back. Malachi finishes with the profanity. Profanely they behaved by marrying people of an idolatrous culture. I mean, what else do you want? Genesis, Malachi, and all in between. This idea of mixing with people who are anti-Yahweh God does not, or at least it rarely results in bringing them out. So here's a question, because that seems so cut and dried and easy, because I got asked this the other day. What about godly people who did it? And it worked out okay. I mean, didn't David? I mean, how many non-Israelites did David marry? I was reading that today, this morning, my Bible reading, 2 Samuel was about that. How about those who married, intermarried, and God didn't seem upset at all, and it was righteous guys? What would you say to that when you have a culture? I mean, Genesis, Deuteronomy, Malachi, and then you get into the New Testament, 2 Corinthians, which isn't necessarily about marriage, but it's about being careful who you link yourself to, and some ideas about marrying in the Lord. What do you say about stories like David? That's what I said. That's what I said. Okay, God's way is always right. There are definitely cases where men did things that were not God's will and God suffered through that, suffered with them for some great purpose. And so maybe that's the case with David. What else? Yeah, some of the consequences aren't immediate. And I would say this from what I remembered, and I remember it well because I read it 10 hours ago. His boys were kind of a mess. David's boys killed each other. Absalom chased him from town. Where I am in my Bible reading right now is David's hiding over across the Kidron Brook. I thought about Kidron. He's hiding across the brook. Absalom's taken over. He killed his other brother a little while ago. It's an absolute disaster. So you might say that as well. I did read some commentaries on why it was sometimes it worked out okay. There weren't any consequences. And there were some interesting things suggested. One of them is there were cases where people converted out of the idolatry. So while they still were not technically Israelites, they were like people who are heathens converting to Christ and then marrying a Christian, right? Take, for instance, Rahab. What did Rahab say as she was getting ready to exit Jericho? What'd she say about God? Remember? I know who your God is. I know all about your God. Your God is the God who delivered the people, who took out Egypt. Your God is the God who allowed you to cross the Red Sea. She was converting toward God. And so there's one thing that can be said. And then also another commentary suggested that in cases, and I think this is interesting, in cases where the culture around you is suppressed and serve you, you could take a wife from there and it wouldn't affect you as much. But when they were powerful cultures, they would draw you away. And I think that's interesting because it doesn't justify the behavior. It just says you're taking a chance. You're taking a chance on whether that culture is strong enough to influence your culture. Comment? Yes, sir?
Yeah, I think God controls the bloodline more than he is anything else. There's a lot of things going on around that. Yeah. That bloodline is going to remain true all the way across.
Yeah, so there were some of God's patience had to do with the ultimate Christ plan and not so much the individual behavior. But I'll tell you this about intermarrying. Genesis, Deuteronomy, Malachi, and about 30 places in between. The idea of linking yourself to someone who is against the service of the God of heaven is a recipe for disaster over and over again, and even in David's life and Solomon's life. I guess I'm not finding any good examples. Maybe I thought I had some, but I don't. These didn't always pan out. So there's kind of the story there, and it mirrors this idea. And why is that important for the original readers of Genesis? Because they're about to cross the river. They're going into the land. They're pure. They're purified. And they're really going to be sort of baptized again into the land, and they needed to be careful with whom they associated themselves. Okay, so as the movie moves forward just a little bit, I don't even know what word I was trying to say. Usually I know what I was trying to say. Question four. How do Judah's action in Genesis 38:18, next part of the story, mirror Esau's actions back in Genesis 25? Remember what Judah did?
Physical
desire. In one case, in this case, it's a woman that he wants to be with, and he's very nonchalant about it. Are you taken aback by the nonchalantness of this? I think what we know about sort of God's way of approaching morality, this seems like this odd sort of laid-back deal. But it's very much like Esau, who wanted what he wanted when he wanted it. He wanted that red stuff, right? There's this idea of giving up whatever. You want something? I'll give you whatever. Here's my staff. Here's my coat. It doesn't matter, because he's not thinking consequentially. He's enamored by the immediate. He doesn't care what it cost him in the moment, because he doesn't see a long-term cost. He would be wrong about that. Esau would be wrong about that. Similar?
They gave up something valuable for something very temporary.
Yeah. Valuable for the temporary. What a great thought. Let's just do this for the rest of the night. Let's do nothing else but this. We got to move on. The immediate, the carnal, the physical, immediate costs don't matter because they're immediate, but there was long-term ramifications. Look at what happens in this story. Look at what almost happens in this story. Some of the things that really pan out here, very much like Esau. How does Judah demonstrate hypocrisy in Genesis 38:24? He's willing to have her killed. Tamar has been with someone. Kill her. Right?
He wanted to punish her for basically his own sin. They both committed the sin.
Yeah, he didn't know that this was the person. And that's the hypocrisy, right? The hypocrisy is, I know exactly what we're going to do. We're going to kill this woman, burn her for that. And then she produces those emblems. And he recognizes, wait a minute, I did this. So he burns himself, right? I die too. Now, the rules change when it's you, right? So the hypocrisy of it, fact is, if she was an adulteress or unholy, then her death would have been a lawful thing. Although we don't have the law of Moses yet, but culturally it would have been a lawful thing. But he was able to get around that when it involved him. Yes?
It seemed like Judah
had a double standard to me here. I mean, he could go in and commit fornication with a harlot, but Tamar, she couldn't be a harlot.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, this is a Women Appreciation Month. Is that what this is? Or is it Women Appreciation Week? I don't know. We appreciate you guys. But they weren't treated fairly. Women were not treated with the same equity that men were treated. His point is, even if he hadn't been the one who was with her, he was in fact with a harlot. He did that. He acted immorally, no consequence. She acts immorally, exceptional consequences. And God saves her through the revelation, those emblems that she was able to get and keep. Verse 18, the seal, the cord, the staff that she was able to produce. Now, when Judah realized that it happened, what was his judgment of Tamar? And I'm going to ask you the second question in a minute. But when he finds out, what does... It's very interesting. The evolution of Judah. What does he say when he finds out that this is the person he had lied with? He's promoting her now, right? And I think, to be honest, that this is a moment of humility in him. That he recognizes what has happened. Let's look at it. Verse 24, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. Verse 24, bring her out and let her be burned. We're in Genesis 38. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law and she produces them. Verse 26, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. And you remember that story. There was another son, and she waited for that son to come of age, and he did not give her to that son. Son wanted someone else, perhaps. And so he realizes, I've done her wrong, and yet she's more righteous than me, I guess because she hoarded important materials. She was able to protect herself and to show that there was at least some integrity. And look, this is not your culture. This is not 21st century American culture. So the idea of her having made a deal with a man and then producing that and that getting her off the hook, that wouldn't make sense to us today. In their culture, somewhat different.
He didn't want to give her his third son because he was afraid the third son would die. So it was for purely selfish reasons. But that culture that we don't understand, he owed her a child because that was how she got any value whatsoever in that culture. She got what she kind of deserved because she was supposed to have a child for one of his children.
We know what happened with the second son and how he would not produce her with her for a child, and then she didn't get the third chance. Not a justification of the behavior, but I think this story is really more about Judah, and it's more about his behavior and his growth and sort of the humility. And it goes to this question, is this necessarily God's judgment of her? What'd you put for that? I don't think this is about God. I don't see God in this story. I see a moment of self-assessment. I think this is Judah's sort of, you are the man, David and Nathan. You are the man. Well, that changes everything. I'm the man who stole the person. This moment of self-assessment, and maybe just part of his evolution, because we see a better Judah later on, more wise Judah further down the road. Mr. Noble?
What you really see in all this is how self-centeredness works in a person's life. What he wanted, because he wanted it, was all right. She was caught accused of adultery, and she was altogether wrong and deserved to die until it was proved that, or revealed that he was just as guilty as she was. Then it was okay because it was because he was guilty of that. We can justify anything. A self-centered person, if they want something, can justify what they did, why they did it, what they want. Murderers on death row can justify the most heinous just because it's them.
All right. Now you can resonate that and carry it on to answer this question, or you can look at the bigger picture. But my question for you is, why is this chapter here? It's so oddly placed. I mean, your exposition of what happened and his attitude is dead on, exactly right. But I mean, this is the Joseph story, isn't it? I mean, this is supposed to be about how the people got from where they were to Egypt, and the readers would recognize their history. Why is there a very odd, because I know a lot of things happened. This isn't the only thing that happened. There are probably all kinds of strange cultural stories that took place. What is this doing in your Bible? What do you think the answer is to that question? If somebody quotes, "The secret things belong to God," I'm walking out of here. Give me an idea.
This is the lineage of Jesus. I mean, this is where he comes from, this tribe. And those twins that were born, he comes from that lineage.
Okay, that gets to our last question. What Kelly's talking about is question 7. What surprising thing do we learn in Matthew chapter 1, verse 3? Who is Perez? Lineage of Jesus. Judah, and then Perez, and then on forward. There are two boys, by the way. I'm looking at two of them, verse 29 and verse 30. There are two of them there, and there's this lineage of Jesus. So part of what the author might be doing, which, by the way, would not really have been that big a deal for the original audience. It's a bigger deal for you because you're looking at it now thinking, okay, there's this story of how God way back then worked through, you know, these means to get to Jesus, and Matthew 1 opens with it. Although they would have had some sense of Judah being the line of the kings, and this is some of their history. So that's one of the surprising things, I guess. What else? Why is this chapter here? Lineage of Jesus. Could just be some of the moral stuff, right? We made some moral points. Could be about immediate gratification. Could be about long-term consequences. Could be about being careful who you marry, intermarriage. Could be about hypocrisy. It's definitely about hypocrisy and self-centeredness. Everybody knew you were going to say that because you're right. So there could be this moral implication reasons, but again, I think there had to have been hundreds of those. But this is the only one that gets thrown into the Joseph story. The connection has got to be Judah. It's got to be Tamar and Perez and Christ, Matthew chapter 1, because that was so important for the Jews to track. Any comments or questions about that?
When Jacob was about to die, he blessed Judah. And that's in chapter 49 of Genesis. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes.
Yeah. Chapter 49, verse 10. Beautiful section, verses 8 through 12. Lots of messianic language there. So I would look at God's greater plan. Jonathan, you want to add to that?
You've got Ishmael and the second Isaac, who then is the son of promise. You have Jacob and Esau, Esau being the son of promise. You've got this secondary, I would say secondary generation child. And once again, it's the second one that becomes the lineage of Christ. It's the second generation of Israelites that becomes the one, or the ones that get to go in the promised land. I just think it's interesting how they correlate together.
All right, interesting. I would put some of that together, and I would say this. I think you see this from Genesis 1, this idea of crime and punishment, right? All this sin. Everybody does it. All this sin, there are these consequences. God's plan to save men is so much stronger than the sin of mankind. No man's sin can stop it. Adam and Eve blew it, didn't they? I mean, I'd be eating, I think it's apples. They blew it, but God's plan kept going. Cain killed Abel, Seth came. The world turned dark, Noah built a boat. Tower got built. God spread them out just like he wanted them to spread out. Abraham made mistakes. God persevered. Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, all the way through, there's sin on every page of Genesis. And they never justified, never justifiable. There are consequences. But God's great plan to save penitent souls cannot be stopped. Even through sinful circumstances. That's what this is, a sinful circumstance. God can bring about something that continues to move the redemption. Because look, if everybody sinned, well, let me rephrase. If God needed some sinless person to keep the good news going forward, the good news would be dead. because everybody sins. God finds a way, even through sinners like this guy, to keep somehow, there are consequences, none of the sin is justified, but somehow keep the gospel going. I mean, think about the fact that you still have a Bible. How many sinners have there been on earth from the time the Bible was originally written? All of them. You got a Bible in your hands. God keeps it going. I'm overly impressed and really drawn to this idea because that has such great ramifications for us today. We mess up, we face consequences, we can lose our souls over it, but God will get you home because nothing you and I can do can stop what is built for you. Whether you enjoy it or not, that's up to you. But there's this sense that God can get good out of any situation to His glory. So that's something that stood out to me. All right, we're going to get to some familiar material, Potiphar's wife and the like. Do you have any comments or questions about chapter 38? Okay, it won't take us really long on the next three chapters. It is three chapters, but you know it pretty well. So we have Joseph is at Potiphar's house now. How is Joseph in Potiphar's house a representation of God's promises to Abraham as recorded in, remember the three promises, Genesis chapter 12? I left this question in. It's kind of a difficultly worded question, but I left it in as it was because I think if you get it, you got it. It's kind of neat. So what did you put for this idea of Joseph's experience in Potiphar's house being a lot like Abraham's experience in Genesis 12?
Bless them that bless you.
Okay. Bless those who bless you. Abraham and Abimelech and all these others were blessed because of their association. And the same with Jacob and Laban. The same with Joseph and Potiphar. Good. What else? Yes.
Away from his family.
All right, number one, to accomplish what I need you to accomplish, you need to leave your father's home. In the case of Abram, it was north, right? Leave it and travel south. I've got a journey for you to go on, and it's a hard one, and you got to leave home to do it. This wasn't Joseph's choice. He was 17 years old, but it started with you got to go over here. And we know that if he hadn't gone over there, based on the way the plan unfolded, all of his people would have died. They would have all died. You have to leave and go, and you have to be a visitor in a foreign land. They will not all treat you with kindness. Abraham was not treated with kindness everywhere that he went because it wasn't his home. It was their home. He lived in somebody else's home. Look out. I love it when the wording comes together. He lived in somebody else's home under their jurisdiction, and that did not always go well, though he was blessed. Thank you for that. And everybody associated with Abraham was blessed as well. Joseph has to leave his home, go to a place that is owned by someone else, live in someone else's house under their jurisdiction. But as he was blessed, so was everybody else. Potiphar was greatly blessed because of Joseph. It was not easy, but it was part of the plan. It was part of God's plan. You want to talk about providence. It was part of God's plan for all the unpleasant things I just said to you. Leave home, live in a foreign land under what could be great persecution and deception, that happened. And if you will be faithful and have hope against hope, Romans 4, Abraham had hope against hope. He believed, he never stopped believing that God's great promise would come to pass. And that's Joseph. I mean, how many of us give up before Joseph gives up? Wait, I know how classes are. Don't raise your hand if you give up before Joseph gives up. Look, we all agreed. Most of us give up. He's 17. His father never came and looked for him. His brothers turned him in. He was too young and dumb to know that he should have told the stories of the dreams differently. He's 17. How many of us give up when we're in this house and this woman lies about us? How many of us give up there? Very, very important ideas here about the way that he approached that. Consider Genesis 39, 8 and 9. Why did Joseph refuse to commit sin with Potiphar's wife? And again, you know the story. We can't read through it every class. You know it. How does this mirror why we should avoid sin? There are at least two reasons.
He talks about it being a sin against God, but that's actually his second reason. The first reason was because Potiphar had been so good to him, how could he possibly commit an evil against him?
Yeah, that's strong. He starts with Potiphar. He's been good to me. I've been good to him. He's given me one rule and I can't break it. And also, why would I do this against God? Right? Is that the two things that you put there? There may have been some other things. He may have not been attracted to her. He may have been turned off by the sin of the approach. I don't know. But what he said is, I have to honor him and I have to honor God. So it's not the order in which we would usually put it, but it's the same two things. This is a perfect opportunity to slow down a minute and promote our gospel meeting. We haven't talked a lot about our gospel meeting, but it starts in 10 days. Reagan McClenney will be here in 10 days, and his whole week is about what Jesus said in Matthew 22. What did Jesus say? Upon these two things hang all the laws and the prophets. What are they? Love God, love your neighbor. Love God, love your neighbor. You're reading it in reverse order, but it doesn't change anything. I love my neighbor. He's my neighbor. He trusts me, I trust him, we have a relationship, I have to honor that. And then secondly, as someone said very, very clearly, he said in verse 9, Genesis 39, 9, there's no one greater in this house than I. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Love my neighbor, love my God. You know, it really is that simple. I'm excited. I didn't put the topics on the bold flyer, thank you. The flyer in the back, mainly because I always change at least one sermon while I'm there somewhere, and I don't like it when they put the topics because people call you out on it. But I read the topics and they're great. He's going to help us really dig into this idea of how strong you can be if you just get two ideas. Love God, honor God, and love the people around you. So good. So that's what happened here. Loved his neighbor and loved God. Matthew 22, 37 through 39, the two great commandments. Any other comments on 8 or 9? So proud of Joseph. Look at question 10. He's doing so well. He's godly. He doesn't act in immorality. What was the great result of Joseph's faithfulness to the Lord? Well, God blessed him for a little while. Then what happened? You're so noble. You get to go to jail. Not only will you be thrown into jail, of course God's not doing this, you understand that. What was the result of Joseph's faithfulness to the Lord? One, jail. Two, the people that you care about. I mean, Potiphar is basically his father. I mean, he doesn't have a father figure. I don't know what their age difference is. Maybe he's like a brother. He doesn't have any brothers or any father. He's got Potiphar. And he's been there a while, by the way, because this whole story takes about, you know, maybe 10 years or so to develop. The person that you love and care about will think of you as evil and cast you out. He's already been cast out once. His brothers cast him out of his homeland. Now he's been cast out of the only home that he knows. So because you've made the right choice, you have suffered the loss of your freedom and the loss of anybody that you love, anybody that you have in your life. That's what he got. What he didn't get is attitude. He never got attitude. He's like Job. He never turned away from being faithful to the Lord. We talk about tests like we know what a test is. I don't know what a test is. A test is this. Long-term lingering abandonment and deception against you. And then he gets in prison. How does that work out? Well, God blesses him. God blesses him greatly. And then he's got a ticket out. And like 3 days later, the guy forgets that he made him a promise. And he has to wait 2 more years. You guys know the ages, right? How old? I already told you. How old is Joseph when the brothers sell him? And how old is Joseph when the 7 years of plenty begin?
47.
That is way off. You know what? You added the two right answers, though. He's 30. He's 30 when it starts. Don't look at me like that. Look at, all right, fine. Chapter 41, verse 46. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And then after that, you have the 7 years and the events take place. So we're talking about a lengthy spread of time that he's going through all this with lots of problems, but his faith held. What a great story of providence. There's a fella named, anybody ever heard the name J.W. McGarvey? Obviously, I never met him. I think he passed away in the early 20th century, but he was a powerful writer, and I have some of his books. And I would just say this, if you go home tonight and you think, I wonder if I have a J.W. McGarvey book, and you look to your library and you find one and you didn't know it was there, give it to me. You'll never miss it. You didn't know it was there. I like to collect two guys, R.L. Whiteside and J.W. McGarvey. I really like collecting their writings. But he wrote, he had sermons that got dictated, got transcribed. And one of them is The Providence of Joseph. God's working through years of loneliness, well, abandonment, struggle, sin around him, forsaken by his family. God's plan to bring out a good result took one man through great challenges. But that's what God's providence demands of faithful people. Sometimes. Those journeys. And we've got to keep the grand plan in mind as we move through. All right, so there's Potiphar's wife in the story that leads him into prison, 8, 9, and 10. Any comments or questions? Anybody has skipped over on that? Okay. How would Joseph's experience in prison, remember who's reading the letter, be an encouragement to Moses' original audience? So you know they've been through a little prison. And now they're wandering around, wondering what's going to happen. How does this story of his experience help them?
God never forgot him.
Okay, God never, thank you, forgot him. Through all of it, God never forgot them. That's something that Moses had just told them. Though they were in prison for 400 years, not each one of them, generation after generation, God never forsook or forgot them. God remembered them. What else? What happened while he was in the prison? He raises up to the level, and then what's the end of the story? The end of the story is freedom. But not just freedom. Ultimately, it's what? What does he get in the end of the story? He goes from the lowest of the low, the dungeon, to the penthouse, as it were. From the bottom to the top. Victory by faith. It wasn't the action of others that got him out of this. In fact, if it had been left up to others, he'd have never gotten out. It wasn't some immediate payoff that proved that he was on the right track. There was no immediate payoff at all. There's no clear picture of what the outcome was going to be. He just had faith. The entire journey, he never gave up his faith. God freed him and blessed him. And boy, that's something that the Israelites need. I was thinking about them standing on the east edge of the Jordan River. They got to cross this river and walk up that way and circle a city they can't even see inside of. Their victory, they're out of prison, but they're not in the penthouse yet. I mean, they're going through that process. It would just take a great measure of faith that God's providence dominates my behavior. And God's promises dictate who I am, just like Joseph. Just like I am Joseph. They'd have said that, they'd have walked right across that river as soon as they said it. He's inspirational. How did the cupbearer reward Joseph's dream interpretation? Thanks.
He forgot about him first.
2 years. Forgets about him. 2 years. Like I was reading in some notes today, it was like 3 days later. He forgot him. The truth is he didn't care. He forgot about him selectively. I mean, it doesn't matter. He doesn't want to give this man any credit. And so he's there for 2 years. So it's more of the difficulties of Joseph's journey and the way that God continued to rise him to the top. We've said this, I've said this in sermons before, but every time somebody pushed him down low, God would bring him to the highest level in that element. Like from the bottom of a pit, the highest level you can get is at least serving somebody in their house. Now you're in a servant's house and you become the number one person in a servant's house. So they put you down in a jail and you become the number one assistant to the jailer. And then you get put into Pharaoh's council and you end up being second only to Pharaoh himself. This idea of faith and adversity, God lifts them up to the highest level. Such a great story. How would Joseph... Well, I already asked that one, and I asked that one. Let's go to 13. What dreams did Pharaoh have? Strange dreams. Fat cows, got it. Seven of them, looking good. Seven thin ones, okay. Kind of makes some sense, maybe. And then... Yeah. But what do the seven thin cows do?
They eat.
And that's where it got really strange. And then, of course, you have the grain. You have the thick, beautiful grain. You have the thin grain, and the thin grain devours the great grain. And remember that dreams then had sufficiency. They had significance. You know, they meant something in a lot of occasions, and Pharaoh understood that. What was Joseph's interpretation of the dream? Seven fat cows, seven lean cows devour the fat cows. 7 years of famine, or 7 years of plenty, but the 7 years of plenty are going to be good. They're going to be good. But the 7 years of famine are so bad that you would even forget that there were 7 years of plenty. That's why the lean cows ate the fat cows. It's not just seven cows and seven cows. It's they're going to be so bad that it'll just devour everything that you had. Why so?
Because Joseph said he didn't have the interpretation God did.
All right, good. Giving the glory to God. Good point. Gave the glory to God all the way through. His mentioning of God, very powerful in this providential story. All right, so we get through it a little bit. Joseph interprets the dream. What was Joseph's advice to Pharaoh, and what reward did Joseph receive? What's his advice? Prepare and store incredibly for the 7 years. And then as a result of that, Pharaoh said, we need to find somebody who can do this, somebody who we can feel that is responsible enough. And of course, he chooses Joseph. Joseph is now 30 years old, and he's come a really long way in the second half of his life so far. You okay with that now, Paul? Okay, cool. With numbers, I'm not confident against you, bro. All right. So he moves up to the top, and he has these great things happen. It's really interesting. I was anybody ever read or audiobook the it's a financial book on something in Babylon or something. It's an old, what is it called?
The Richest Man in Babylon.
No, that's not it. No, that's it. The Richest Man in Babylon. But it cites Joseph's approach to this as the right way to approach saving and preparation and looking to your future. Really interesting, because he used seven good years to prepare for seven terrible years. So he did great with what he had. It's really interesting. Something you might want to check out. How were the names of Joseph's two sons good messages for wilderness wandering Jews? End of chapter 41. Names mean things. Verses 51 and 52. First one, Manasseh. What did that mean? God made me, I'm in chapter 41, verse 51. God made me forget all my trouble in my father's household. Second one, Ephraim. Ephraim means what? God is made. And remember, there can one and then the other. His first thought is, God has caused me to forget all the turmoil of my past. What a great approach. What a great approach. He didn't hold that. And then second one is, God has put great fruitfulness in my life. And of course, an Israelite needed to know that. We got to put aside everything that's happened in the past. Our own fathers let us down. We got to put that away. Our own fathers let us down. God has blessed us greatly. Let's take a quick look at that as we pick up on Sunday morning, because the name game and the reason they're named things is really fascinating. And then please be ready for pages 40 and 41 for Sunday morning.